Welcome, everyone, to the 17th live session of our Neuroscience Training Summit. My name is Christy Peoples. I'm a producer here at Sounds True, and I'll be your host. Today, Janina Fisher will be teaching on working with the neurobiological legacy of trauma. She's broadcasting live from Oakland, California, while the Sounds True team and I are here in our Boulder studios. A free recording of this session will remain accessible for 24 hours. And if you wish, you can also purchase the entire series with unlimited access to each recording, transcripts from each session, and bonus gifts from our presenters. And now, it's my honor to introduce you to Dr. Janina Fisher. Janina Fisher is a licensed clinical psychologist in private practice and an international writer and lecturer on the treatment of trauma. She's the author of the newly released book, Healing the Fragmented Selves of Trauma and Survivors, as well as the co-author of Sensory Motor Psychotherapy, Interventions for Attachment and Trauma. Dr. Fisher is also the Director of Psychological Services for Chiron Clinics UK, the Assistant Educational Director of Sensory Motor Psychotherapy Institute, and she's an instructor at the Bessel van der Kolk's Trauma Center. She is an EMDRIA approved consultant and credit provider, and she served as the president of the New England Society for the Treatment of Trauma and Dissociation. She's also been an instructor at Harvard Medical School. This woman is very busy. Welcome, Janina.
Oh, thank you, Christy. So true. So true. Today, we're going to talk about what neuroscience has helped us understand about trauma and its persistence long past the events that caused it. As William Faulkner wrote, the past isn't dead and buried. In fact, it isn't even past. And that is the issue with trauma. Because although when we talk about trauma, we're often referring to events, it's not the events that are the issue. Trauma is an event that once over lives behind what I call a living legacy of symptoms. Symptoms ranging from depression to irritability to loss of interest or pleasure, numbing, difficulty sleeping, highly agitated or shut down nervous systems. Every symptom of major depression, every symptom of PTSD. But in addition, shame, nightmares and flashbacks, all of the anxiety disorders are highly correlated with early traumatic experience, chronic pain disorders, addictions, eating disorders, suicidality, self-harm, and even borderline personality disorder. We often forget that personality disorders are virtually synonymous with trauma. And this living legacy continues to exert an impact on survivors of traumatic events. Even as far back as Breuer and Freud, who remarked, at first sight, it seems extraordinary that events experienced so long ago should continue to operate so intensely, that their recollection should not be liable to the wearing away process to which we see all memories succumb. We must, however, mention another remarkable fact, that these memories, unlike the memories of their lives, of ordinary experience, are not at the patient's disposal. On the contrary, these experiences are completely absent from the patient's memory when they are in a normal psychical state or are only present in a highly summary form. So way, way back in the late 1800s, Breuer and Freud were wrestling with the same issues that modern therapists and modern trauma survivors struggle with. Now, when we talk about memory, and I certainly talk about memory quite a bit because I'm always saying my memory isn't what it used to be, we're talking as if there's one part of the brain that holds memory. And the kind of memory we're talking about is verbal explicit memory, meaning our autobiographical memories. Oh, let me tell you about my trip to Australia. Or our fund of knowledge. Let me see if I still remember my multiplication tables. Our working memory, the ability to remember where we put the car keys, where we put our glasses, the ability to connect ideas that are related. And explicit memory, which is the type of memory we're most conscious of, is voluntary. We can say, I'm not going to go there. We can choose not to retrieve certain memories. And we can deliberately choose to retrieve them. Now, brain science has taught us that actually trauma is more clearly remembered and more deeply encoded as a nonverbal experience. And, you know, for decades, people were confused about the amnesia for trauma reported by so many survivors, not realizing, as I say to my clients, oh, don't you worry, you have plenty of memory. You know, that anxiety that hits you around 6 or 7 o'clock at night, that's memory too. That waking up in the morning feeling dread or shame, that's memory too. Memory isn't just a memory of what happened, first this, then this, then this. Memories include implicit memories, feeling memories, body memories, visual memories, olfactory, auditory, but also muscle memory. Think about pianists and violinists. They rely on muscle memory. We have autonomic memory. Our nervous systems remember the responses that were adaptive or necessary way back when. We have vestibular memory that helps us keep our balance. And when we remember trauma, there's a reason why we don't encode trauma as a fully clear, concise, sequential narrative. So if we take a quick look at the brain here, when we're under threat, when we're in danger, the brain has particular responses which are geared not to, are you going to remember this 20 years later? They're geared to, are you going to survive it right now? Which is really what we would want our brains to do. You know, Bruce Perry says the brain's first priority is survival. Everything else, all the many, many, many other activities of the brain come second. So when we experience threat, the prefrontal cortex shuts down, as you can see here, so that we rely on our innate animal defense instincts. We don't stand around thinking, should I flee or should I fight? We react. The hippocampus, see that little yellow structure there, is the part of the brain that has to process experiences at a nonverbal level before we remember them verbally years and years later. But who needs a hippocampus when you're running for your life? So the hippocampus is inhibited under threat. But what isn't inhibited is that little red structure, the amygdala, which is the brain's fire alarm, smoke detector, and it is the emotional memory center. It stores emotional memory center. So just think of the implications of storing your nonverbal traumatic memories in your smoke detector. It means that any time the toast burns, the smoke detector is going to go off. The smoke detector becomes highly, highly sensitized. And that undoubtedly was adaptive. Think back to the cavemen and women. Because remembering the story of the mountain lion who attacked your cousin and killed him, that story is not going to help you survive another day with predators roaming in the very areas where you want to pick nuts and berries. So when your body remembers instead of your left brain, it means that you hear a swishing of the grass and you stop and you look around. Because your body is saying that swishing could be the wind, but it could also be something else. This is what Bessel van der Kolk discovered when he began to run the first brain scan studies of what happens in the brain when trauma survivors remember. He writes, under conditions of extreme stress, there is a failure of hippocampal memory processing, which results in an inability to integrate incoming input into a coherent autobiographical narrative, leaving the sensory elements of the experience unintegrated and unattached. These sensory elements are then prone to return when a sufficient number of them are activated by current reminders. And what that those sensory elements without words are implicit memories. Survivors of trauma are left with a vast array of implicit memories, which, because they represent the unprocessed raw experience, are often overwhelming. And worst of all, they're disconnected from the event. As Dan Siegel says, they don't carry with them the internal sensation that something is being recalled. And that's the difficulty when we remember implicitly, is we suddenly sense something's not right. We feel fear, yet nothing is going on. Or hopelessness, even though there are indicators of hope all around us. And that hopelessness or that anxiety doesn't come with a label that says age 6 or 1958. And so what happens instead, because we don't voluntarily retrieve implicit memories are activated by cues, by anything that is directly or indirectly related to the original experience. As Bruce Ecker says, emotional or implicit memory converts the past into an expectation of the future, but without our awareness, and that is both a blessing and a curse. It is a blessing, he says, because we rely daily on emotional implicit memory to navigate us. Yet it also is a curse because it makes the worst experiences in our past persist as felt emotional realities in the present, and in our present sense of the future. Right? So not only do these implicit memories taint the present, but also our sense of the future. And this is what we call state-specific memory. And, you know, I came into this field when the major, I was about to say only, but the major form of therapy was Freud's talking cure. And we believed, without knowing anything about the brain, about neuroscience, we believed that as we and our clients told our stories, that there would be an emotional reorganization of those experiences. But what we didn't know is that when you're narrating the story of something that's happened, that's not open to change. Feeling memories, state-specific memories, are open to revision. Because here's what happens to many trauma survivors, right? We saw in the diagram of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, this part of the brain here, shuts down, so we rely on instinct. But when it shuts down, we lose the part of the brain that witnesses experience. And with an inhibited hippocampus and an inhibited prefrontal cortex, the memories are left implicit and raw and unprocessed. So when triggers, when cues evoke those feeling memories, it feels like something happening now. It doesn't feel like a narrative of something that happened then. And so this idea of triggers and triggering, that we remember trauma as everyday experiences trigger the body and feeling memories. And the range of cues that can trigger those memories ranges, not just the obvious cues. We all know the obvious cues that would trigger any trauma survivor. But the subtle times of day, particular types of weather, particular days of the week, particular smells or sounds or colors, a shift in body language, a frown, a disappointment on the list of triggers that my clients create, being disappointed and disappointing others, being told no is a very, very common trigger. And the result is that trauma survivors become phobic of their memories because the narrating of the event evokes those feeling and body memories. As Remarque wrote after the First World War, it's too dangerous for me to put these things into words. I'm afraid they might become gigantic and I'd be no longer able to master them. Or Appelfeld, the moment any Holocaust memory or shred of a memory was about to float upwards, we would fight against it as though against evil spirits. So the experience is not that we remember trauma as something past, as something horrible but finished. As Kafka wrote, the experience is, I am a memory come alive. And that's why survivors of trauma continue to suffer for years and decades after the events are over. It's as if their bodies remember the moment of shock and and there's a kind of freezing. And somehow there is no memory of there was the shock, there was the pain, and then it was over, and I knew I survived. And without that experience of, oh, then it was over, it doesn't feel over in the trauma survivor's body. And one of the things, one of Bessel van der Kolk's many, many studies that has always seemed very important to me is his study of adults who had woken in the midst of surgery out of the anesthesia. And even though they were able to do what was the gold standard in those days, to construct a narrative of this horrific experience, they still continued to have feeling and body memories. And that's important. No matter how many times we tell our stories, the feeling and body memories are not going to be processed. They're still going to be vulnerable to being triggered. And especially when the traumatic experiences were childhood experiences, because children don't remember in narrative form. Even my 14-year-old granddaughter is likely to say, oh, I had a great sleepover with my friends. I had a great time in school. And then when I say, oh, what did you do? She says, I don't remember. Because the narrative isn't important to her. She remembers the feeling of what happened. And that's very, very important. But it's a problem when we don't know we're remembering. And as Dan Siegel points out, nonverbal memories don't feel like memories. He writes, when the images and sensations of experience remain in implicit only form, they remain in unassembled neural disarray, not tagged as representations derived from the past. And that's why so often trauma survivors feel crazy. They feel possessed because these feelings, these intense, overwhelming, or underwhelming, right, this experience of not feeling when most people would, is very, very confusing. It doesn't feel like memory, and no one has told them. When you feel those feelings, that might be a feeling memory. He goes on to say, such implicit-only memories continue to shape the subjective feeling we have of our here and now realities. And, so I've just lost my quote here, of our here and now realities, and, very importantly, the sense of who we are moment to moment. And therefore, who others are moment to moment. So look at some of the different forms of implicit memory and be curious. You know, there's really nothing wrong with questioning our feelings. I think it's been a very, in a way, unpopular position in the psychotherapy field, but it's so liberating to recognize that an unpleasant feeling is a feeling memory. So emotions that are intrusive, meaning they hit us like a ton of bricks out of the blue, and they're disproportional to the stimulus. We feel, and I hate this word, overreacting. I think often people say, oh, you're overreacting, or we question ourselves, I'm overreacting. I assume that overreacting means triggered. And suddenly there's a fear that hits us in the solar plexus, or the heat of anger comes up, or drenching in shame. Intrusive thoughts, especially critical, judgmental, shaming thoughts, thoughts that predict failure, you're going to screw this up, you're going to fail, or you're going to be hurt. Dreams, nightmares, and flashbacks are all forms of memory. Again, there are what I call regular dreams, and then there are trauma dreams. And we all, and trauma survivors includes Eric Lud, we all have ordinary dreams. They're different from trauma dreams. Trauma dreams are generally nightmares, and they're about the expectation of something bad being about to happen. Impulses. If you're someone who has the impulse to run when in an uncomfortable or stressful situation, when the impulse is to hurt the body or to go for a drink or a drug that will change your state, when we have impulses to isolate, when we have impulses to hide in bed, all of those impulses, if they're repeated, tend to be memories of how we adapted or survived. Hearing voices, not a symptom of being crazy, but often a symptom of trauma. There are lots and lots of studies that show that trauma survivors are likely to hear voices. And all kinds of weird and unsettling body sensations, from dizziness, from the room spinning, to various kinds of pain. And then there's yet another kind of memory. We have a memory system for habit, and called the procedural memory system. If you drive a car, if you ride a bike, if you walk or walk your dog, you have procedural memory, because riding a bike, driving a car, are memory for function and habit, and that's what procedural memory is. And we also remember habits of responding socially. If you're someone who looks other people in the eye and puts out your hand for a handshake, that's procedural memory. Saying please and thank you, procedural memory. Making eye contact, you know, in some cultures, children are taught not to make eye contact, that that's disrespectful. In other cultures, we're taught to make eye contact. And procedural memory also, as Dan Siegel says, shapes how we experience the present and how we anticipate the future, readying us in the present moment for what comes next based on what we've experienced in the past. And my favorite example of that is something that happens to all of us. You jump in your car intending to go somewhere, and then find yourself driving either home or to the office or to whatever is the most familiar place you're likely to generally drive. So procedural memory is a bounce. It's all over. All the things you do without thinking, all the things you do in automatic pilot, those are all procedural memory. And there are particular types of procedural memory that it's important to know because they are a reflection of the trauma too. Difficulty or inability making eye contact, feeling intensely uncomfortable or afraid, or being afraid not to be observant of the facial expressions of others. Collapsed posture, and a slowing down of the body and nervous system can be the adaptation, the procedural learning of submission, right? The head is bowed, ready for shame or compliance. Or we might, as a result of trauma, live in a body that's braced and rigid, ready for action. Often, trauma survivors have very perfectionistic tendencies or even symptoms that get diagnosed as OCD. Those are often memory too. What I call default settings, which I really means those habits to which we always, always default under stress. I'm thinking of individuals I've known who under stress immediately get into bed or immediately start to criticize or shame themselves or immediately act out or immediately isolate. If you're someone who's always very emotionally expressive, that's one kind of procedural learning. If you're someone who tends to keep your emotions like a poker hand, that's procedural learning. If you're someone who always gets angry or never gets angry, that's procedural learning. And we often don't realize that these are a form of memory. Right? It's the memory of the habit of defaulting to compliance because it was safer to do so. Or the body memory of defaulting to I'm ready to fight because that was the only way to survive. So we might talk about traumatic memory, but if you look at this diagram of the brain, what you'll notice is that we don't have a part of the brain that is the memory section. We have different memory departments, so to speak, in different parts of the brain. We have the narrative of the events here in the left prefrontal cortex. We have the hippocampus. When the hippocampus is functioning, it processes all of our experiences at a nonverbal level so that that processed nonverbal experience can be relayed to the left brain and words added to it. So it's often called the brain's filing cabinet because its job, its processing job, includes sequencing and organizing experience. Our procedural memories are stored in a different part of the brain, the putamen. We've got our emotional memories in the amygdala, and then we have instinctive responses, which certainly also are part of what trauma survivors struggle with, stored in the caudate nucleus. And how trauma survivors find a way to be in relationship to traumatic memories, especially the implicit memories that are likely to get triggered Just getting up in the morning, just walking outside, just going to work, is a challenge. And I think it's important to know that, so that trauma survivors know that they're not alone in struggling with how to be in relationship to the memories. And Bruin studied the relationship of trauma survivors to their memories. And what he found was that all of his subjects still got triggered. But those who he called the completed successfully resolved group consisted of people who still got triggered, but could recognize it. Oh, as I say to my clients, oh shit, I'm triggered. I say, that's what I wish for you, that someday you'll just be able to say, oh shit, I got triggered. Now the oh shit is important because I want them to feel the ordinariness of it, that it's annoying and it is disruptive to get triggered, but it's something that they can learn to live with. He also found a group of trauma survivors with what he called chronic incomplete emotional processing. Individuals who were consistently flooded by these feeling memories, by the bodily reactions, and they got so preoccupied with the trauma. Again, I don't want to make that sound intentional. If you're getting triggered and your daily experience is a landmine field of triggers, then it's going to be very hard not to be focused on the past because the past keeps hitting you in the face. And that group found it very hard to stay focused on now. And then he found a group of subjects who sustained, on a sustained basis, suppressed and avoided the past. Not necessarily with a lot of intention and concentration, often in a very automatic way. And perfectly understandable also. But I think it's important for us to ask, what kind of relationship do we want to have to the memories? Because if one has been traumatized, they are there in the body. Now, Bessel van der Kolk's findings that we store trauma in largely in a non-verbal way, and that the inhibition of the prefrontal cortex gets in the way of remembering trauma as an event that is over, writes, it is in the very nature of traumatic memory to be dissociated and to be initially stored in sensory fragments without a coherent semantic component. The persistence of intrusive sensations related to the trauma, even after the construction of a narrative, contradicts the notion that learning to put the traumatic experiences into words will reliably help to abolish the occurrence of flashbacks. And, you know, I feel that this is such an important message, which the psychotherapy field hasn't been so good about disseminating, that putting traumatic experiences into words doesn't resolve the implicit feeling and body memories. And that is, in a way, false advertising. We've said to trauma survivors for years, if you can just tell your story, you will be free. And they've worked hard to overcome the fear of telling the story, only to find that actually telling the story may, for some, be a relief, for some, bring a sense of I did it, I survived, but it doesn't resolve the implicit memories. So I'm very, one of my missions in the field is to create equal opportunity for implicit memories. Because of Freud, because of his talking cure, we have focused on autobiographical memory. We didn't know. Brain science was very slow to recognize implicit memories. And yet, that's what our clients come for. In 36 years of practice, my clients have not come to me saying, I had an event. They've come to me saying, I can't sleep at night. I am so depressed. I'm having panic attacks. I can't let myself get close to anyone. I can't enjoy my life. So my mission is to create equal opportunity for implicit and explicit memory, and to help clients recognize, or help survivors recognize, that implicit memories are just as valid as autobiographical narrative memories. As Bessel van der Kolk writes, successful treatment of traumatic memory should consist, I would say, of helping patients to overcome the traumatic imprints that dominate their lives. The sensations, emotions, and actions that are not relevant to the demands of the present, but are triggered by current events that keep reactivating old trauma-based states of mind. So if we help individuals notice the traumatic imprints, it's going to require education. It's going to require naming. That hopelessness sounds like a feeling memory of being that little child in a dangerous, dangerous world and having no way out. So what happens if you notice the hopelessness as memory? Because so often, trauma survivors suffer from hopelessness that is not relevant to their present situation, but is absolutely understandable as a memory of the past. So we have to get clients interested, and by using that language. So I say, oh, I wonder if the panic attacks you're having are feeling flashbacks. Let's be curious about what triggers them. That hopeless feeling. I wonder if that's a long, slow flashback of the days and weeks and months that you were like a child prisoner in a detention camp. When our clients engage over and over again in patterns or automatic reactions that they say, I don't want to be doing this. The example that comes to mind from very, very long ago was of a trauma survivor who got triggered by separation. Separation anxiety was probably her major symptom. which again, if we're thinking about events, doesn't make sense. Because given the events she'd experienced as a child, it would have been more logical, we could say, for her to be struggling with fear and distrust rather than with separation anxiety. And the pattern she had was that when her husband had to leave the house, she would go into a panic. She'd get very angry at him. And sometimes she would even run after his car. And she felt crazy. I'm a suburban housewife. What am I doing running after my husband's car? And then over time, she began to notice that that was a procedural memory. That it's not safe to be left alone, was actually a very key and very accurate memory of her trauma. So helping the client notice these patterns, notice these feelings, and asking them to be curious. Could we be curious about this as a feeling memory or as a body memory? And we have to, for that reason, address the issue of triggering. Because it is the exposure to triggers that activate the implicit memories, causing the symptoms that constitute the living legacy of trauma. And to me, that's very important to make sure that individuals understand about triggering. Because otherwise, how are they going to make sense of their reactions? So we can educate traumatized individuals about triggers and triggering. I say to clients, you know, if you were traumatized in the context of family, in the context of your closest relationships, in the context of neighborhood, community, those are the contexts in which you will be triggered. And session after session, we deconstruct the relationship between feelings and triggers. So here's the example I just want to share. In this example, the client with whom I'm working is a 50-year-old man, and who was struggling with a number of addictions, including addiction to food, to alcohol, and to sex. And often I was very delighted to see him because he often didn't come the next session if he broke his sobriety. And I was so pleased that he had come in. And notice, I wanted him to be more curious about what triggered him than worried or regretful or remorseful or ashamed. So I say in a quite cheerful way, I say, oh, I'm so glad you could tell me that you used last night. What triggered you? And his answer is the first answer of every trauma survivor. I don't know. And then he said, I just hate my job. Huh. What was going on just before you used? Because that's the best way to figure out a trigger, is to ask, what was going on just before? And he said, people were getting to me. They have no respect. And that's always something I want to be curious about. What is it that tells us that someone has no respect? And so I say, how could you tell people were getting to you that they had no respect? And he says, they weren't doing their jobs. I can't rely on anyone. Which I know is a huge trigger for him. And I say, wow, that's a pretty big trigger. People who don't do their jobs, so you have to carry the load. Because here's his trauma history in a nutshell. Violent, abusive father who was an alcoholic and neglectful of his wife and children, so that this client was the one who had to nurse his mother through a terminal illness and death from cancer when he was just 14. So what's a parent who neglects his dying wife and lets his 14-year-old son do the caretaking? That's a father who's not doing his job. So that is the trigger. So I say, whoa, people who don't do their job, so you have to carry the load. Notice I don't reference the event because I want him to get the feeling memory part. And he says, yeah, just like I have my whole life. And then I go on, when you got triggered, what feelings came up? I just wanted a burger and a beer, which I did have to laugh because last I knew, that's not an emotion. And I say, oh, so the trauma trigger triggered the food trigger. And he says, yeah, fuck it. I don't have to feel this shit. And then I reframe it for him so he can see the logic. I say, well, drinking does calm the nervous system. You were just trying to make the feelings disappear. And what I found is that if I help individuals see the logic of their triggered reactions, it's much easier for them to see the downside. And he said, yeah, but now I'm feeling stupid and my head is killing me and I don't want to lose my wife. And so I say, well, we have to figure out a way for you to know your trigger, right? Because we don't have to change his behavior. We simply have to help him to be more aware of when he's triggered. I think the idea of changing our behavior willfully, taking control of our behavior, tends not to work because of the phenomenon of triggering. So I say, we have to figure out a way for you to know you're triggered. People are going to be assholes sometimes. This is just, I wanted to acknowledge that's a fact of life. In his fantasies, as in the fantasies of many people who've been hurt, is that they're going to find a world in which people are never mean. They're never assholes. So I want to make that disclaimer. And I said, you don't want to relapse over all those assholes. And he says, that's for sure. They're not worth it. So over and over again, acknowledging triggers, not exploring. Notice I didn't mention his father. I didn't mention his mother. I simply acknowledged the trigger because I knew if I had mentioned his father or mother, he would have said, I don't want to talk about it. But he was more than willing to acknowledge the trigger. And if he were to begin remembering the events, it would stir up those feeling memories that I'm trying to help him to modulate and manage so that he doesn't have to resort to alcohol. So acknowledging triggering and recognizing that it's normal, whether we've had trauma or not, we all get triggered. We're all sensitive to cues connected to negative and to positive past experiences. Find a new language. I'm scared makes us feel more scared. I'm depressed makes us feel more depressed. I'm ashamed makes us feel more ashamed. So, but if we say, I'm noticing a lot of feeling memories, I'm noticing that familiar feeling flashback of hopelessness, that is different. You know, the goal in the trauma treatment world used to be trying to help clients to go there. Now, in the modern trauma field, we're more interested in helping them stay here, because that's the difficulty in post-traumatic stress, is that via the implicit memories, survivors keep going there over and over, learning to stay here. And when we say, I'm triggered, we're here. When we say, I'm afraid something bad's going to happen, we're there. And it's a very subtle difference. When we can say, oh, this feels familiar, I wonder if it's a feeling memory, we're here. We're here. And it's a wonderful thing. So to transform implicit memory means changing our relationship to it and learning to notice feeling memories that are just part of our everyday experience, learning to notice the feeling memories as a historical record of how we survived. For instance, shame. You know, shame is a survival response. It gets us to be compliant and bow our heads and take our punishment. It's very, very adaptive for traumatized children. We can connect implicit memories to the child we once were. We can connect them to the body as we do in sensory motor psychotherapy. And I should add, the connecting of the feeling and body memories to a child part is really the work that I've written about in Healing the Fragmented Selves of Trauma Survivors. And it's a way of processing trauma that's very, very gentle. And again, it's about being here. Donald Meichenbaum says, the biggest change over the last 30 years is our understanding of trauma treatment, is its goal. What is important is not the story of the terrible things that happened, but developing a healing narrative with which the survivor can live now. Right? Because what's important is having a present and a future. We all have a past. A traumatic past is much harder to lay to rest than simply a painful or distressing past. But the focus on developing a healing narrative changes that. So I think of my model for trauma work as a transformation model, as a repair model, de-emphasizing what caused the damage, the events, and instead really upping the emphasis on repairing the damage, on changing our relationship to whatever has happened to us so that we can live with it in a reasonably comfortable way. So that transformation or repair model assumes that our interventions begin with the present. We have to change what happens now. And to accept and work with the implicit memories, because those implicit memories can actually help us to resolve the story. And, you know, if we're still living in shame 10 or 20 or 30 years later, working with the shame as a memory of how we helped ourselves to survive can change the whole relationship to the shame and to ourselves. The shame can become the hero of the story rather than the punishment. So I realize that we have to end, and there's so much to say. One of the things I just want to really emphasize is this idea that we've had in the trauma field for so many years, that trauma survivors need a witness. And of course, that made logical sense when we first began to emphasize that 30 years ago. But that impulse to have a listener, to have a witness, that's most likely also a memory, that we remember the longing to have somebody get it, to have somebody listen, to have someone believe us. And we have to make sure that when we witness our client's story, we help them to be there. We help them to not only hear themselves tell the story, but feel us there with them. So what I say to my clients is, I just want you to pause for a moment as you tell the story and notice what it's like to be telling someone and to feel, or to be telling me and feeling me here and listening. Because if we don't witness the being witnessed, it isn't going to help us. So let me just end with these wonderful words of Bessel van der Kolk's: telling the story to ourselves is more important than telling it to someone else. And then I'll add his other words. No matter what modality, whatever the approach we use, the goal of trauma treatment is to be here and not there. And I would add, the goal is to be here and to feel, not just to know intellectually, to feel it is really over. It is really over. So thank you all for listening. And Christy, do we have any questions from our listeners?
Janina, yes, we have many questions. So
okay.
Thank you so very much for that rich presentation. I want to extend the invitation to our viewers to submit questions if and as they arise for you. And you can do so by entering them into the field below this video. So, Janina, I want to start with a piece about telling one's story, and this comes from Ricky, who writes, "I'm in a support group for survivors of sexual trauma, and even though I'm so grateful for the safe space to tell our stories, which I believe saved my life, I don't want to feel like a victim. How can I empower myself to feel safe in the other parts of my life?"
Well, that is a great, great question, and you know, I'm glad that you're speaking to the both the gifts and the risks of support groups, because support groups can be very, very triggering as well. I think, you know, the first thing I teach my clients is to notice any distressing thought, feeling, or physical reaction as triggering. And not to say that there aren't events in everyday life that can be upsetting and disturbing, but it's a place to start. And to help them notice the distressing thoughts, feelings, and physical reactions as triggering, as feeling memory, as a young child part having a feeling memory. Because each time you go out into that big world around us and something feels overwhelming, disturbing, frightening, that in that moment, if you can hold steady and just, you could even visualize your support group around you and just keep noticing the reaction as triggering, as feeling memory. Now, it doesn't mean that we can't also look around to see if there's any immediate danger. But for the most part, I find trauma survivors are good at avoiding immediate danger. The biggest problem is how much of life they have to avoid because it's triggering. So that very, very simple, okay, I'm triggered, I'm just triggered. It's just a feeling memory. And you know, recently I was asked, well, is it going to help me? Am I going to feel better if I say I'm triggered? And I said, well, it's not going to take away the feelings, but it's going to tell you where you are. And she thought for a moment and she said, that would be good. That would be good. Mm. So, yeah, other questions?
This one comes from Claire. What can be done to heal the trauma of a family? Our oldest brother was molested by a neighbor, and none of us was consciously aware of it until many years later after piecing it together. Looking back, I think we were complicit in that silence. Our brother has never said anything about it and struggles with issues of drug and alcohol abuse today. I think we're still experiencing our own sort of phobia around this trauma. How can we surface this issue and heal as a family?
Well, you know, I think when you're a family, and I've seen this particularly running groups for mothers of incest survivors, when someone you love is traumatized, that's traumatizing for you. So I completely understand how traumatized all the family must feel. And then on top of that, it's traumatic to see a loved one wrestling with addictions issues and feeling this threat. Oh my God, what if? Because those what ifs are always there. And so I think the most important question is, what would best help your brother? Because being able to talk about it as a family might actually be best for all of you. It isn't clear if it would be best for him. Because the drug and alcohol issues suggest that he's in the throes of it. And if you all were to sit down, even with the best intentions and the most loving hearts, the discussion of the past would stir up his implicit memories and further strain his nervous system, which could actually make the drug and alcohol issues worse. So I think the most important thing is to acknowledge to him as a family, as individuals, or is probably less overwhelming than as a group, all in one room, and to let him know that you all want to be there now. That's what we did with the mothers' groups, and they had an extraordinary impact both on the mothers and their children. They're usually their adult children, because the adult children longed for that support as kids. The mothers, once they knew what had happened, longed to have been able to provide it. So it was reparative for all. But again, it wasn't about talking about the trauma. It was about right here, right now, how can we give you the support that we wish we could have given you then? Is there another question?
Yes. This one comes from Debbie. Does facing the predator of your trauma help resolve the trauma, or is it likely re-traumatizing the victim?
We used to believe that facing the perpetrator, I mean, this was the Courage to Heal way back in the late 80s, early 90s, which prescribed confronting the perpetrator and often confronting the family, the non-offending family members. And what we found was that confronting the perpetrator did not work. And I'm thinking of clients I've worked with who've testified in court against their perpetrators. And despite the guilty verdicts, despite the perpetrators being sent to jail, the trauma was not resolved. So it isn't to say that our people should not testify in legal action against perpetrators, but the facing of the perpetrator does not resolve the trauma. And I think what it can do is it can help overcome some of the fear of seeing the perpetrator's face. But I think the risks, as you say, the risks are also high. And the important thing is that so often the confronting of the perpetrator does not end in the way that individuals would wish. It doesn't end with an acknowledgement, doesn't end with the truth, it doesn't end with an apology. And so those are other reasons why we have to be careful with that.
Janina, is it useful in those instances where the victim wants to confront the perpetrator, is it useful to write letters that maybe don't get mailed or to journal about it? Or what's the healthiest way to express that emotion toward a perpetrator?
Well, certainly writing letters would be a very, very good way. I think also, you know, for many individuals I've known, what's turned out to be the healthiest, most, I guess you could say, successful way is to channel that anger or that indignation and to show the perpetrator, even if not directly, by overcoming their shame, facing the world. Because, you know, facing the world actually makes a bigger difference in our lives than facing the perpetrator. When we can face the world, we can live a full, rich, satisfying life. If we can face the perpetrator, but we can't face the world, then actually our lives are more compromised. So I always say, the best revenge is living well. So if you live well, if you have joy, if you have confidence, if you have the things that you always wanted to have in your life, that's the best revenge.
Dolly writes, "As a survivor, sometimes it's hard for me to make out what a trigger is versus what I can justifiably be upset about in the moment because of something that's happening. How can I know my upset is rooted in the present?"
Well, I'm so glad you asked that question. Thank you for asking it, because it gives me a chance to clarify something, as you say, very, very important. Many, many distressing events in present adult life can also be triggers. So often what you're dealing with is a distressing event in the present that also is triggering. It's what I call a double whammy. You're dealing with all the distressing feelings that anyone would have after being chewed out by a boss, after being hurt by a partner. And on top of that, it's triggering. And I think that we really don't talk enough about those instances where it's both. And I think it is important, because we don't want to overlook that normal daily life is filled with stresses and disappointments. And as I said to my client, you know, people are going to be assholes. And when they're not only assholes, but they're triggering, it's really much, much harder.
Latoya writes, "If remembering trauma feels like me, how can I learn to recognize who I really am at rest?"
Mm-hmm. That's a very, 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 very interesting question. And I think the answer to it is found in this process of recognizing what's memory. And you know, you might at first feel as if, oh great, you know, if I'm using that as my basis, I'm just remembering all day long. But who am I? But you know, think of it this way: you are the person who survived those events. When you get triggered, when you have triggered reactions, you are the person who survived those feelings. And you're the person who's noticing them now. And maybe you're the person who can nonetheless have a good laugh, who can nonetheless care for your children, who can nonetheless go to work. And that's actually much more special. You know, one of my biggest pet peeves, that I'm so glad I have a chance to share it, is this whole idea of a false self, being a fake self. Because, first of all, take any 10 of us, we would all have a different fake self, because whoever we're faking is going to be a reflection of us. We're going to choose who we're going to act like, because we like the way this person acts better than the way someone else acts. And often what we're doing when we accuse ourselves of faking it is what we're doing is we're engaging in the very, very important instinctive response of keeping on, keeping on. And we don't give that enough credit in this, particularly in the psychotherapy world, that is actually a very important, courageous act. Where would we be today if human beings gave up and didn't keep keeping on? So you're also the person who's kept on keeping on, and that's important. So I think you will, as you become an observer of present experience, which is what we become when we're noticing oh shit, I'm triggered, then you're going to have more and more of a sense. You might not be able to put it into words, but I think you'll feel yourself observing these triggers and triggering.
We've got a question here from Phil, who writes, how can I deal with the shame that I continue to feel that comes from my inability to step up and take care of emotional issues as they arise? Why in the hell should I feel shame anyway?
Because it's a feeling memory. I wish that shame were not part of the human repertoire, and yet I know why it's there. Shame is there as an automatic reaction because it facilitates compliance. And I would guess that somewhere in your story, there was a need to go along. There was a need to give up trying to fight City Hall, or maybe there was that it was never ever safe to protest or fight or try to change your situation. So shame facilitates our being seen and not heard. It facilitates shutting up and not expressing our opinions, not asserting ourselves. It actually it lessens fear too. So if you feel fear, and then it's immediately followed by shame, we're going to feel less afraid. So shame serves a variety of survival purposes when we are young or when we're in a traumatic context. And then it continues to get triggered. And if it's getting triggered around attention to feelings, it says to me, well, those feelings then must have been dangerous at some point in your life. And the shame is always saying, don't pay any attention to those feelings. Go to the shame. Don't go to the feeling. Notice that we don't have control over these reactions. Our survival responses are driven by the lower areas of our brain, the nonverbal areas. We don't have any more control over them than a rabbit has over the impulse to flee when the rabbit sees us pull into the driveway.
Jude asks, does this model apply to people whose histories don't include serious trauma, but also just the ordinary pain of living?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was thinking about this just this past few days because I'm speaking at a couples conference next weekend. And this is the primary problem that couples suffer from, is that the feeling memories of disappointment, of not being seen, of being rejected or abandoned as kids, even if it's not in a traumatic context, those feelings get triggered by our partners in relationship. And that's why we have such intense feeling reactions in our closest relationships. So yes, absolutely.
We've got a question here from Nick, who writes, just hearing you say that the disarray of implicit memory can make us feel crazy makes me feel less crazy. I haven't been able to express it prior to now, but it gives me permission to get curious about what's happening to me. What are some of the ways to safely work with exploring these feelings and emotions without re-traumatizing myself?
I think the best way is to to assume, to ask the question, how did this reaction help me to survive? You know, there's something that happens in the brain and body when we tell a story from the beginning. So, for instance, the classic thing that we would have advised 20 years ago is notice the feelings that make you feel crazy and notice if they're familiar and then start to free associate to what events they might have been connected. But that often means digging up landmines, which can set them off. So, but if you ask yourself the question, is this familiar? And if you assume that if it's familiar, it's memory. And you either feel for yourself, wow, that would have been a lot for a 5-year-old or a 10-year-old to feel. If you ask yourself, how might that feeling or reaction have helped me survive? Those are very, very safe ways. So, you know, we don't stress enough that simply acknowledging that something was hard really often satisfies the need we have to feel that our reactions are normal and natural. And to be able to self-validate them.
Janine, we have time for one more question. And I'd like to ask, since we've covered the brain-body somatic response to trauma and healing trauma, what would you suggest for people who have issues with sitting still or meditation? What might be some good spiritual practice to help support healing trauma?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question, because I think where it's meaningful to the individual, spirituality is such an important part of healing. Yes, sitting meditation can be very, very difficult for trauma survivors. Many trauma survivors, on the contrary, love meditation. So, and so what I would suggest for those who want to give meditation a try would be to buy a guided meditation tape so that there isn't so much alone in the silence of the mind aspect to meditation, because you're following the voice on the tape. Many, many people like Jon Kabat-Zinn's guided meditation tapes. I'm sure there are many on the Sounds True website that would be helpful for trauma survivors. And then I think finding what has meaning. Is there any belief in anything, whether it's a belief in nature, if it's a belief in intentionality, if it's a belief in the cosmos, whatever belief, you know, often individuals had important spiritual relationships as kids that got tainted by the trauma. And I find this to be true, especially for trauma survivors who had families who were involved in a particular church or synagogue, some particular religious tradition. And then that religious tradition became triggering. Often it's an important part of healing the trauma to take back their spirituality. And you know, there's such an incredible variety of spiritual and meditation tapes and books that I would encourage trauma survivors to just experiment and to see what speaks to you. Because having a sense of belief and confidence in something bigger than ourselves, especially when there's a sense that the spirit or the spiritual world is benign and caring, can be tremendously healing.
Janina, thank you very much for your time today and for sharing this wealth of information with us.
My pleasure. This is always such a wonderful event. I enjoy it, and thank you for moderating this. It was great. Thanks.
The honor was mine indeed. This concludes the 17th live session of our Neuroscience Training Summit. Once again, our very deep gratitude to Dr. Janina Fisher for this outstanding presentation. Please note that the recording of this session will remain accessible for free for 24 hours. And if you wish, you can also purchase the entire series with unlimited access to each recording, transcripts from each session, along with bonus gifts from our presenters. I'd also like to extend my deep gratitude to everyone who joined us today, because we certainly appreciated your participation as well as the questions that you submitted. Please join us for our next live session with Joe Dispenza. That's going to take place 5.5 hours from now, March 28th, 2017, at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. For Sounds True, I'm Christy Peoples, thanking you so very much for joining us. SoundsTrue.com. Many voices, one journey.